It's great to be here today. This is only my second Sunstone, so you'll have to forgive me. I'm kind of a newbie still in this environment, at least I feel like one. The title of my talk today is From Bible to Grimoire, Recovering the Gold Plates. In 1984, a letter by Martin Harris surfaced. It conveyed an unfamiliar and, to some, disturbing story of the Book of Mormon, including a trickster spirit in the form of a salamander. Though a forgery, the salamander letter conveyed a historical truth in the way it brought the discovery of the gold plates back into its proper context within Joseph Smith's activities as a treasure seer. Of course, at the time of its appearance, these folk magical elements were precisely the thing that scandalized. The late 20th century LDS Church had gone through a protracted process of integrating itself into a majority largely Protestant American culture. As part of this process of cultural integration, Mormons had largely abandoned aspects of their distinctively Mormon habitus, sort of culturally way of being or practices, to the point that the magical and divinatory elements of early Mormonism had become alien to the majority of Mormons. Thanks in no small part to this cultural amnesia, much of the earliest scholarship on Freemasonry, magic, and Hermeticism in early Mormonism met with a hostile response from some in the LDS community. Today, this same groundbreaking work by such scholars as Reed C. Durham, D. Michael Quinn, and John L. Brook is being validated, refined, and expanded upon by a new generation of scholars. Still, within Mormonism, theological and cultural impediments remain. In his landmark biography of Joseph Smith, Professor Richard Bushman refreshingly acknowledged Joseph Smith's participation in folk magic, but he still sought to draw a distinction between Joseph the treasure seer and Joseph the prophet, and made the discovery of the Book of Mormon, or the recovery of the Book of Mormon, the dividing line between these two roles. Folk magic was thus implicitly consigned to a theological demimonde and defined as incompatible with both the fully Mormon prophetic role and also Mormon scripture. Bushman's Book of Mormon is thus securely biblical in nature and shares nothing in common with such a document as a grimoire, a magical grimoire. Such a theological construct denies the reality of centuries of Christian practice, wherein magic, esotericism, and Christianity were considered by their practitioners to be wholly compatible. Therefore, I propose that we consider the Book of Mormon's gold plates as an esoteric artifact in contradistinction to the book's predominantly domesticated image as a companion to the King James Bible. This is not to exclude the obviously biblical qualities of the Book of Mormon, but to extend our interpretive field in order to embrace magical and esoteric books, as well as narratives describing their burial and recovery. The purpose of doing so is to start to reflect on how our visions of the Book of Mormon as an artifact, informed by the narratives of its production and handling, as well as artistic depictions of it, shape the culture that reveres the book. In contemporary Mormonism, much effort is made to emphasize the biblical nature of the Book of Mormon. LDS missionaries pass out attractive blue volumes bearing the subtitle Another Testament of Jesus Christ that assimilates this more exotic volume to the very familiar New Testament. Upscale versions of the Book of Mormon are bound with the Bible in a way that shows quite clearly the book's aspirations to be the equal of its elder sibling of Holy Writ. Yet when one considers the history of the Bible as a collection of texts constructed from a long process of scholarly shifting, sifting, translation, and conciliar deliberation, the gold plates, miraculously discovered and divinely translated, have very little in common with the comparatively staid Bible. Of course, that's a point of contention, I'm sure. The young treasure seer and truth seeker, Joseph Smith, was guided to the Book of Mormon's gold plates by revelation from an angel, and wore the same seer stone he used to search for other treasures. Buried in a stone box resembling an altar with sacred royal relics of a lost Hebrew civilization, the Book of Mormon was part of a treasure trove Don Bradley has perceptively identified as a Nephite Ark of the Covenant. The text itself consisted of reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics inscribed on gold plates. Recovered at the vernal equinox after a 4-year period of trial, repentance, and angelic instruction, The Book of Mormon plates were not an archaeological discovery so much as the culmination of a process of initiation. Indeed, elements of both the story of the text's discovery and the description of the book itself would have been readily intelligible to Hermetic and magical adepts familiar with similar traditions reaching back at least as far as the Hellenistic period, so the period just after Alexander the Great's stunning career of conquest. It is important to familiarize oneself with some of these traditions in order to appreciate the ways in which the Book of Mormon, as an esoteric artifact, departs from the biblical model. I begin today with the demotic Egyptian novel Setna Kaimuas and the Mummies, which dates to the early Ptolemaic period. And I do so, I'm starting here, because Hellenistic Egypt was one of the ancient Mediterranean world's most important cultural melting pots, wherein elements of Egyptian, Greek, Jewish, and Roman religions, philosophies, and magics came together and exerted a great deal of influence on the subsequent development of the Western esoteric traditions, so like alchemy, magic, hermeticism, a lot of esoteric and occult stuff. The novel Setna begins with the story of Neneferkaptah, an Egyptian prince who is told by a mysterious Heliopolitan priest of the existence of a magical book written by the hand of the god Thoth and buried in a gold box surrounded by an eternal serpent under the waters of the Koptos River. According to the priest, the scroll in the box contained two formulas. The first formula provided control over nature, and the second, a vision of the gods. Using magic, Neneferkaptah locates the book, endures a series of trials, including the defeat of the guardian serpent, retrieves the book, and successfully recites the formulas, thus acquiring the ability to control nature and see the gods. Thoth then punishes him by killing him and his family. It's a really bad outcome. We can revisit the implications for the assassination of Joseph Smith. All are embalmed and buried by Pharaoh. Then a prince named Setna visits the tomb, overcomes the opposition of the guardian ghost of Neneferkaptah, and then steals Thoth's magical book. The theme of the discovery of a sacred or magical book in a box or a tomb, or a box in a tomb, became widely popular in the ancient Mediterranean. According to Pliny the Elder, the author of a huge and mysterious encyclopedia, Pliny the Elder contains a story about the familiar philosopher Democritus and how he found his magical knowledge. So for those of you who are familiar with Greek philosophers, you may be surprised to find out that Democritus was also credited with being a great magician. Well, according to this story, Democritus obtained his knowledge of magic from a book he found in the tomb of the magician Dardanus of Phoenicia. To the next story. One of the most famous and most written about events in Roman history was the appearance of the lost books of Rome's second king, Numa, in 181 BC. So, books that had been lost supposedly for like five centuries. A scribe by the name of Petilius was digging on his farm on the slopes of the Janiculum Hill, the site of the Roman god Janus's ancient palace temple, when he discovered the tomb of King Numa and a box containing the king's writings on pontifical law, so how Romans should perform their sacrifices, and also Pythagorean writings. And Pythagoras is a crown prince of esoteric knowledge through the ages, even up to today. Considered dangerous, the two scrolls were taken to the urban praetor and burned sacrificially in the Comitium, probably in front of a statue of Pythagoras himself, on the orders of the Senate. Like Joseph Smith's gold plates, the books of Numa were thus returned to heaven. Unlike the gold plates, no copy of Numa's writing survived. The tradition of divine books found in tombs endured on into Christian late antiquity and beyond. John Moschus' 6th century spiritual meadow contains a story about Pope Leo placing a letter on the tomb of Peter, which, when reopened by Leo, showed corrections by the dead apostle. This story seems related to the persistent Christian tradition of the so-called heavenly letter. Western Christian stories of this letter describe it as written by the hand of Christ on a tablet of stone and placed on the altar of the Church of St. Peter in Jerusalem or the tomb of St. Peter in Rome. It has been proposed that the heavenly letter tradition derived from the tradition of letters of Jesus, so the only known pseudepigraphical letter of Jesus, at least known to me, to Abgar of Edessa. The first, so we have two letters, the first is written during his life, the second after Jesus' resurrection. So Jesus was writing letters to Abgar of Edessa after he was resurrected. Versions of the second letter offer its bearer magical protection. Letters of Jesus, both those deposited with Peter and also those written to Abgar, although developing independently, find their way into medieval and early modern magical amulets. A type of heavenly letter even found its way to the New World in the hands of German immigrants. Greco-Egyptian traditions regarding the buried book were handed down in medieval Arabic alchemical literature. Here one finds the story of the tablet of Hermes Trismegistus, or Hermes the Thrice Great, an avatar of the god Thoth and father of alchemy. The book of the secret of creation and the art of nature, attributed to one Balinus, who may be understood to be the Greco-Roman wizard Apollonius of Tyana, contains the story of Apollonius' discovery of an emerald tablet in the city of Tyana. Apollonius found the tablet in the hands of a corpse sitting on a throne, resting in an underground vault under a statue of the god Hermes. Upon the tablet was inscribed the mystical doctrine of Hermes, the thrice great, so influential in sympathetic magic and alchemy. Quote, that which is below is like that which is above, end quote. The story of Hermes' emerald tablet, buried in a subterranean chamber, resembles the much later Freemasonic legend of Enoch's gold tablet. George Oliver's Antiquities of Freemasonry recounts the legend of Enoch's construction of a 9-chambered subterranean temple on the Holy Mount, the future site of Solomon's temple. When the wickedness and impending doom of humankind installed in him a fear for the future of the sacred mysteries, in the 9th and innermost chamber he deposited, quote, a plate of gold in the form of an equilateral triangle, each of whose sides was 18 inches, which he enriched with precious stones and encrusted it on a triangular agate of the same dimensions. On this gold plate, he engraved the ineffable characters he had seen in his vision. And alone, in silence and solitude, he descended through the 9 portals into the temple and placed this invaluable treasure upon a cubical pedestal of white marble. Enoch's burial of a gold plate bearing the ineffable name of God to protect the mysteries from a wicked generation doomed to destruction in the flood is, I would argue, analogous to Moroni's burial of the gold plates at a time when his people were ripened in iniquity and soon to be wiped out by war. The plate's resting place in a Nephite Ark of the Covenant became the New World analog for Enoch's subterranean temple and its gold plate, which was covered by the flood and its victims. And there's a nice rendering from the George Washington Masonic Museum of the discovery, the recovery of Enoch's gold plate by men working for Solomon when he was constructing his temple. The legend of Enoch's subterranean temple formed the backstory to the Masonic initiation ritual of the 13th degree, or Royal Arch of Enoch in Scottish Rite Freemasonry. In other words, similar to the demonic novel Setna, the Enoch's gold plate is implicated in its initiatory narrative context, so a narrative context or story of initiation. The struggle for and miraculous recovery of a divine book bearing hidden knowledge represented the initiation process and the fruits of its successful outcome, respectively. The implications for Mormonism are profound. Bushman was, in a sense, entirely correct in viewing the discovery of the Book of Mormon as a turning point in Joseph Smith's religious development. I would argue, however, that this turning point was the culmination of a stage in his esoteric initiation as a seer, not a profound theological shift from folk magician to Mormon prophet. As was the case for adepts of ages past, Joseph, after the numerous trials that constituted his initiation, was rewarded with access to the greater mysteries of the Book of Mormon. And here let me move forward a little bit to Helaman chapter 10, where God confers on Nephi the sealing power. These are, I would argue, the greater mysteries of the Book of Mormon. These mysteries and book are like the magical book of Thoth. They speak of a marvelous power through which nature itself can be manipulated and greater access to the divine can be achieved. Only later would this power, described in the Book of Mormon, be formalized in the construction of the Book of Mormon, of LDS or Mormon priesthood. The formalization of Mormon initiation would follow in the construction of the endowment ritual of the Mormon temple cultus. The forces of cultural assimilation have pushed Mormon esotericism progressively further into a closet where mysterious ritual and recondite knowledge fade from memory. Mormon esotericism is, however, written into the religion's founding narratives, waiting to be explored and explicated. The Book of Mormon may be dressed up and toted like a Bible, but in important ways it bears a greater resemblance to the Emerald Tablet of Hermes or the Gold Plate of Enoch. To understand those distinctions is to understand what comes before the discovery of the Gold Plates and what follows. The development of Mormonism with its distinctive priesthood and temple cultus will remain at least partially opaque until the religion's esoteric roots are fully incorporated into the interpretation of its history, not theologically divided out of it. Once that happens, we may more fully apprehend why it is that the Book of Mormon remains central to the Mormon conversion process, one that hinges on the acquisition of revealed knowledge, Gnosis, and how the Mormon temple endowment is in some respects a more fitting companion to the gold plates than is even the Bible. Thank you.
Of the young Joseph Smith's treasure-seeking efforts was the discovery of the gold plates, inscribed with mysterious characters requiring a special key to translate. From this sacred record, he would later claim to translate the Book of Mormon. Joseph found the plates concealed in a stone coffer buried in a nearby hill on neighbor Randall Robinson's property. Oops, I just gave it away. 'Twas there, impressed with holy awe, a gold engraven plate I saw, with dazzling splendor shine. To us, the grand elect alone, its secret characters are known, ineffable divine. You weren't supposed to know till this point that the poem, which seems to describe Joseph's discovery perfectly, is actually a Masonic ode, depicting one of the legends of the craft. We all know of the influence Freemasonry has had upon Joseph Smith and Mormonism later, years later, in the 1840s in Nauvoo, but have we fully explored the correspondence between Masonry and the story of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon? And why do we see the borrowing so early, at the very beginnings of the establishment of the Church? Narratives of the discovery of the Mormon gold plates share similarities with the lore of Freemasonry, as Trevor has pointed out, and I'm going to get into this a little bit more deeply. most especially that of the Holy Royal Arch. Masonic legend and allegory can be read as foreshadowing the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Okay. In ancient craft masonry, especially its fourth and culminating degree, the Royal Arch, several traditions of loss and recovery coexist. In the first, the biblical prophet Enoch inscribes a sacred word in mystical characters on a golden plate. He hides it beneath Mount Moriah in the Ark of the Covenant. It is to be discovered at a future time by the will of God. A second legend tells how King Solomon recovers the word, a sacred name which can only be shared in the company of three royal companions. When one of the three dies, the word is lost. Finally, in an American Royal Arch version of the story, three companions are set to work on the restoration of Solomon's temple after the Babylonian captivity. During their labors, they discover Solomon's secret chamber and recover Enoch's plate of gold, together with another treasure, the Book of the Law. These Masonic legends imply an established pattern of loss and recovery, apostasy and restoration. By recovering the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith literalized what in Masonry is symbolic and allegorical. The narrative of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon derives from many sources, some of them written years later than the actual events. Mormon writer and historian Dan Vogel states, "Joseph's evolving accounts of his 1823 encounter with the angel make it difficult to recover the core story. In his tellings, he freely recast events, continuing to add material and introduce concepts in order to meet later needs. Moreover, his accounts and those of his family and friends often display certain disparities. Nevertheless, it's fascinating to me to note correspondences in these accounts with Masonic legends. At some point between 1823 and 1833, a Masonic connection with these events was forged, and later narratives appended details, apparently to augment the relationship." A fundamental preoccupation of speculative Freemasonry is the mystical significance of Solomon's temple and all of its appurtenances. Masonic scholars appropriated the Christian tradition of five holy items which are kept in the Sanctum Sanctorum, recasting them in a symbolic and particularly Masonic framework. The first is the Ark of the Covenant. The other four were supposed to have been enclosed in it. In the reactment of the lodge, the high priest opens a replica of the ark to show the contents to the candidates. He ceremoniously removes a very ancient book, reading the first and last words in the volume. The principals then simultaneously exclaim, "This is the book of the law, long lost, now found, holiness to the Lord." Next, the high priest brings out of the ark a little pot with manna, Aaron's rod, and the key to the ineffable characters of the degree by which adepts could obtain the hidden meaning of every passage. There are five corresponding particulars in the story of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. What I find interesting is not that they parallel so nicely, but that the Masonic-like elements seem to have been used in the various tellings of the story for their allegorical meaning. In what would later become the official church history, Joseph described the discovery he made on the hill Cumorah. The plates lay deposited in a stone box, he said, under a thick rounded stone of considerable size. Clearing away the debris which had accumulated around the edges, the young smith obtained a lever, which he fixed under the edge of a stone and which, with a little exertion, raised it up. Royal Arch commentary contains some possible symbolism included in the above story. The working tools of a Royal Arch Mason are identified as the crow, pickaxe, and spade, literally used to loosen soil, prepare it for digging, and remove rubbish. These are used emblematically for more noble purposes. By them, the speculative Mason is first reminded by the crow to lift the heavy weight of passions and prejudices from his mind. The pickaxe prompts him to loosen the hold of sin and folly on his life, while the metaphorical spade impels him to remove the rubbish of vice and ignorance. Joseph Smith shared in the Christian Freemason's anxious concern to reform his character and build a more perfect spiritual life. "I often felt condemned for my weaknesses and imperfections," he noted. He confessed that as a young man, he frequently fell into many foolish errors and displayed the corruption of human nature. Besides, Joseph was warned by an angel that he could not obtain the plates if his heart was impure. In common with the royal arch tradition which it echoes, the account of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon may be read as allegory. Here, one perceives elements of Smith's own struggles to remove the dirt and rubbish in his life, to confront those flaws he felt marred his own character, and to bring forth truth from the earth, to recover from deep within himself something true, authentic, and holy. Accounts written by Oliver Cowdery and Orson Pratt also characterized the covering stone as an arch, and specifically mentioned three small pillars upon which were placed the records. The symbolic importance of these architectural elements, an arch and pillars, are of profound significance to Freemasons and symbolic on many levels. I'm just going to have to skim over and just tell you a couple because there's tons. The surface details of the stone box are remarkable and powerful for those familiar with Masonic lore. Concealed by an ancient prophet on a holy mount, deposited beneath an arched stone, and resting upon pillars, but more strikingly, each of these elements skillfully enhances and amplifies the Masonic themes of loss and restoration inherent in the legendary history of the craft. To Masons, pillars suggest a divine repository, as well as a great and important undertaking. The threefold pillars, representative of the Trinity, additionally hint at the idea that God himself has preserved the record and provided the means of translation. In Freemasonry, the keystone of an arch suggests the word of God, both in the sense of the person of Jesus and the scriptural record that he embodies. Joseph Smith would later inseparably connect the keystone with the book of the law, which he had recovered in this famous quote that we've all heard. Similarities between the golden plate of Enoch and Joseph Smith's golden plates also go far beyond simple physical correspondences, that they were made of gold and found in an excavation under an elevated mount, named respectively Moriah and Cumorah. Enoch's mountaintop vision of a triangular plate of gold is a veiled allusion to the Visio Dei, the vision of God, which is the summit of the Christian's journey and his promised reward of divine transformation and glorification. Additionally, it is a symbolic representation of the Word of God, both record of Scripture restored to mankind and also the glorious person of Jesus Christ, the living Word. For Latter-day Saints, the story Joseph Smith related of his own experience on a mysterious mountaintop in upstate New York mirrors this Masonic legend. In both cases, God showed his approval of the prophet by a personal manifestation and the restoration of his word. Overt Masonic connections with the Book of Mormon plates continued to be made in much later sources. An alleged 1830 interview with Joseph Smith Sr. was published 40 years after the fact and contains a close portrayal of the gold plates. Under the first plate, or lid, lay the spectacles, and on the next page were representations of all the Masonic implements as used by Masons at the present day. Here, Freemasonry is directly tied to golden plates. Masonic tradition holds that one of the distinguishing particulars kept in the Ark of the Covenant was a small pot of manna. This peculiar substance, with the Hebrew name of manhu, what is it, was found on the ground outside the tents of the children of Israel and helped to sustain them as they crossed the wilderness. In Mormon folklore, this is replaced by the liahona, a round brass compass, which Lehi discovered at the door of his tent the morning that he and his family commenced their journey into the wilderness outside of Jerusalem. Like manna, the Liahana continually reminded its bearers of the providence of the Lord and who was directing their journey. Modern Mormons often associate the Liahana with a navigational compass because it contained a spindle which pointed the way whether they should go into the wilderness. However, it is clear by the text that the instrument did not work in the way of a magnetic compass. We tend to picture the Liahona as it was first portrayed by artist Arnold Freiberg. As far as I'm aware, we had no pictorial representation of the Liahona in Mormonism before this painting was commissioned in 1950. Now, artists are heavily dependent on it. You can see that that they're all copying that picture of the Liahona. And personally, I can conceive of the Liahona in no other way. But another possibility is that the Liahona resembled a set of Masonic compasses, which, along with the architect's square, is one of the most identifiable symbols of masonry. This is just my little picture of the Masonic-looking Liahona, but see, I can't get Arnold Freiberg's picture out of my mind. It still looks like that. Both the square and the compasses are used in Masonic ritual to teach symbolic lessons. The Liahona is described as having two spindles within the ball, calling to mind the points of the architect's compasses. As described in the Book of Mormon, they worked according to the faith and diligence and heed which Lehi's family did give unto them. In Freemasonry, the compasses hold a similar allegorical meaning. They circumscribe and keep us within bounds with all mankind. In the second half of the 19th century, a teaching about a cave within the hill Cumorah began surfacing in the writings of several leaders of the church. Brigham Young recalled that when Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery returned some of the gold plates and the Urim and Thummim to the hill Cumorah, the hill opened and they walked into a cave in which there was a large and spacious room. Whether by the light of the sun or artificial light, it was as light as day. Young stated that there were many wagon loads of plates in the room, and that the sword of Laban, which had originally hung on the wall, was laid upon a table across the gold plates with the inscription, "This sword will never be sheathed again until the kingdom of this world become the kingdom of our God and of his Christ." Remarkably, even apparent late embellishments to the story of the obtaining of the gold plates exhibit a consistent mirroring of Masonic thought. Brigham Young's cave, light as day, with Laban's sword atop a holy record, emulates the legend of the Holy Royal Arch. Here, the sacred plate of gold was discovered only when the sun, having gained its meridian height, darted its rays to the center of the vault beneath the keystone they had removed and shone resplendent upon the holy relic. Royal Arch Masonic tradition spoke of a key, which was found with a curiously wrought box. This key, subject of many Masonic lectures, is both literal and symbolic. Not only could it open the box, but it was the means whereby the mysterious characters on the plate of gold might be read. For Joseph, that key was the Urim and Thummim, a revelatory device and a creative expansion upon a Masonic theme. Like the key in Masonry, it's found within the box, together with the mysterious characters upon the gold plates. His identification of the interpreters with that Masonic key is seen in Lucy Max Smith's account of the discovery. In his 1992 book, Joseph Smith's Response to Skepticism, author Robert N. Hollinger rightly observed that many elements in Smith's history were familiar to Freemasons. However, he also assumed that Joseph invented his account from whole cloth. This overlooks the possibility that Joseph described a genuine experience informed by family and cultural exposure to Masonic legend. Masonic references could well have been included to further elucidate the significance of the events. The legendary history of Freemasonry is a metaphor of a latter-day restoration of true religion. The elements of the tale, a delving into the depths by means of interior illumination to recover and restore something lost, are described in Carlyle's Manual of Freemasonry as moral similitudes of material things. Freemasons are frequently admonished to reflect upon the moral significance of those symbols and allegories which comprise its various degrees. Smith did just that as he literalized Masonic allegory and made it into a reality. The coming forth of the Book of Mormon is intimately connected with the backstory of the Royal Arch degree and its discussion of the discovery of the Book of the Law and the restoration of true religion. The symbolic nature of these elements fit into Smith's witness of this uniquely American Book of the Law. The use of Masonic language in his history demonstrates that the coming forth of the Book of Mormon was seen as a fulfillment of Masonic expectations. Later accounts, written by Smith's family members and close associates, perpetuated the Masonic elements, often extending and even intensifying them. The fact that later writers put the story in Masonic terms without prompting from their deceased leader suggests that they, too, understood the cosmological significance inherent in the craft. We don't today. We don't understand that at all like they did earlier. Smith and his 19th century followers saw ideas in Freemasonry which expanded the mind and prepared it for religious salvation. Thank you.
Dillinger explains that treasure hunting of the early modern period was a magical operation that was part and parcel of the old European worldview. There was no magic-free sphere in early modern culture. Treasure hunting also was one of the earliest beginnings of archaeology. The rationale behind these enterprises were mainly an economic one. There was a flourishing market not only for precious stones and metals, but also for antiques. And since the early modern period, or in the early 16th century, however, the cataloging of ancient sites became of great interest to government authorities in particular. And the reason for that was this became important for these kings and other rulers to legitimize their land and, I guess, add to the prestige of their own crown. So we have this transition that happens from treasure seeking to antiquarianism, which eventually takes a step further to archaeology. But we weren't quite there in the early modern period, and neither were we in Joseph Smith's time period quite yet. There was a lot of overlap. But in the early modern period, in the heart of the Renaissance, European countries sought to forge real or imagined connections to biblical and classical antiquity. Discovering lost or previously unknown manuscripts through divine, magical, or even accidental means is an ancient trope that carried over into the late modern period. Perhaps the most widely known discovery narrative is that one that is described in the Bible, which we've already heard about the discovery of the Book of the Law. Now, scholars now overwhelmingly regard the Book of the Law to be a forgery. If it wasn't a forgery, to have never existed at all, but was used as a tangible tool for both religious and political reform. So in discussing certain key strategies employed by forgers, Bart Ehrman, he explains that, quote, even a bolder ploy was used by some forgers in order to explain why it is that the writing by an ancient author was not widely known by readers earlier. The reason? The book was hidden.
and it was discovered only in recent times. End of quote. Needless to say, discovery narratives did not in themselves negate an artifact's purported authenticity. But again, forgers used discovery narratives in order to circumvent skeptical grounds questioning why discovered artifacts were previously unknown. Being that Freemasonry, which centered around the theme of discovering lost and hidden knowledge, had emerged in this modern period at the time that we were having this shift from magical treasure seeking to proto-archaeology, it is therefore understandable that Masonic historians have succeeded in tracing various streams of magical necromantic traditions. Indeed, many Masons study and practice various occult arts. Anti-Masons commonly accuse the fraternity of necromancy. While some Masons lamented that Freemasonry had lost the power of the instruments that they had in the rituals. One person in general, John Fellow, talks about the divining rod, or the rod of Aaron. He says, although some Masons pretend to inherit Aaron's rod, in their hands it has lost its miraculous power. End of quote. All right, but this brings me to actually the focus of my paper, another discovery narrative of, well, apparently forged books and that were found in Granada, Spain. It was a large collection of books in a sacred hillside, and the hillside was named Sacromonte, which means sacred mountain. The first of these books that were found, these lead books, were found by two treasure seekers, and the names of them was Sebastian Lopez and Francisco Garcia. These two companions were originally searching for gold, for a gold mine of King Roderick, but instead they found a book. The year that this first happened, or that this first book was found, was 1595. And over a five-year period, a total of 22 lead books were unearthed. These discoveries caused a tremendous religious sensation throughout Catholic Europe and the Netherlands. Arabist L.P. Harvey remarks, quote, "One can only compare their impact with that of the Dead Sea Scrolls on 21st century biblical scholarship," end of quote. Pretty significant. All of these plates now, these metal plates, lead plates that were found in the hillside, all of them were metal, made of lead, some of them were bound together by rings, or rather, twisted lead. Some were buried in boxes, some were buried with other sacred relics, found in a cave. The engraved plates were also written in a bilingual text. No, not Reformed Egyptian that we get from the gold plates, but no, a Reformed Arabic. Just as the gold plates were said to be Hebrew using Egyptian characters, these lead plates were Spanish or Castilian, using Arabic characters or Arabic script. One of the lead books was in fact sealed, and it was sealed in Solomonic characters. This is particularly interesting to me, as some scholars have shown that the Book of Mormon characters, which have been preserved in surviving transcriptions, resembles Solomonic script. That is an alphabet or cipher that seemingly derives from characters found in occult manuals, where they identify these characters as being Solomonic. Incidentally, one of the characters, I think this is kind of interesting, one of the characters in particular that was especially curious to translators of these lead plates in Granada, they couldn't translate it, they didn't understand what it meant, but they said it looked like spectacles or glasses. Kind of interesting. The lead plates in Granada, Spain assert, and I think this is more interesting, that Christianity had been anciently introduced to Arabic-speaking natives of the land. They were the ancestors of the Arabs who were then being expelled by the Spanish at the time that the lead plates were unearthed. And shortly thereafter, in 1609, a final edict was signed to expel the Moriscos, Moriscos being the Moors who had professed to convert to Christianity. So they were expelled at this time period that they, or were in the process of being expelled during the time period that these lead plates were unearthed. The same thing is happening with the discovery of the gold plates. Now, through westward expansion, of course, the Native Americans were encroached upon and driven west, and just prior to the, and that the books were found just prior to the final passing of the Indian Removal Act in 1830. Now, the lead plates explicitly identify the ancestors of the Moors, these Arab Moors in Granada, as being a chosen people. And the land that they inherited was a New Jerusalem. The books further contain prophecy describing the time that the lead plates were unearthed. It would be a time of religious and political turmoil. It, in particular, the priesthood would be threatened. And there shall be no, quote, there shall be no prophet nor revelation except in appearance only, end of quote. The leaden books titled, or one leaden book in particular, I'll describe here. It's titled The History of the Certainty of the Holy Gospel. And in this book, it describes Angel Gabriel visiting Mary in her house and showing her a sacred record that was written by the hand, by a powerful hand with radiant light on circular tables of precious stones whose value God alone has knowledge of. Mary then transcribes the book on leaden plates, seal it with the seal of Solomon, and explains that God has ordered her to do the plates as was done with the tables of Moses. James will bear this copy to the uttermost quarters of the earth, and there he will conceal it in the holy spot where God shall guard it. There is a sacred record, this sacred record would remain under Gabriel's protection until the heresies and offenses of the world should need this application of the remedy, which is the book. That those offenses and heresies would be disclosed by the hand of the holy priest. God will raise up a lowly creature who shall explain this book, the certainty of the gospel, and the light of the Holy Spirit. When all are satisfied, their law shall become a single law, and error and impiety shall be banished from the world. Mary then gives the tablets to Apostle James, saying, "Go with this copy of the tablets of certainty, and God will, and with this book, go to unto the seashore. God shall provide thee with a little boat, whose pilot God shall be." Whose pilot shall be the angel Gabriel. When ye arrive in Spain, hide the book and the tablets where the dead man comes to life. James did as he was instructed, and as soon as he landed on shore, the shores of Spain, he laid the book and tablets on the ground, and the earth began to gape, and from it came a man who said, "Why hast thou raised me from my tomb when I rested since the time of Moses?" The story ends with James taking the lead documents, recording a history of his own of what had just taken place, and then deposits all of the records into a cave to wait until this great priest shall arise and find them. After which the text would then be translated, and the sealed book would be ready, or I'm sorry, after which the text would be translated and the sealed book would be made, be read by a humble creature by the power of the Holy Spirit, as I already said. Now this book, lead book in particular, was made up of 16 plates. And this was what Mary sealed with the seal of Solomon and ordered it to be deposited in the earth. This text was indecipherable. And resisted all attempts of translation. Some apologists found, however, support for texts like these, or these specific texts that were found. They turned to scripture. And the scriptures that they use might sound very Mormon, not more man, but Mormon. Okay. Passages like Isaiah 2, 1 through 3 says, "In the last day, a mountain of the highest of the Lord's house, and in the last day, the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be prepared on the top of the mountains, and all will flow unto it." Isaiah 29, 11 was also a passage used by apostles, or not apostles, apologists. "And the vision of all shall be unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which when they shall deliver it unto one that is learned, and they shall say, read this. And he shall answer, I cannot, for it is sealed." Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? All right, so moreover, the lead plates apologists, this one in particular, Guerra de Lorca, he shared sentiments with others in stating that Granada was originally founded by Jews that were expelled by Nebuchadnezzar, and that these inhabitants descended from the lost tribes of Israel. Being both Arab and Jew was not a contradiction in many, as we may assume. As apologists of the lead plates maintain that the native Arabs of Granada were indeed Arabs, but according to language, but that it was not the case with regard to religion and ancestry. They actually descended from one of the lost tribes of Israel, as another defender claims. The glorious saints who wrote in Arabic language with Solomonic letters were among the Jews who were sent to Samaria from one of the tribes of Gad and Reuben. They were in Spain, where they could be converted by St. James the Apostle. Certainly, defenders of the lead plates believe that the native Arabs of Granada were not only Jews, but rather Israelites from the lost tribes of Israel, but that they also were Israelites who arrived in Granada at the time of Nebuchadnezzar's expulsion that occurred the same time that this other remnant of, or one of the other groups that we have in the Book of Mormon, Nephi's family, left in 600 BC to the New World. Okay. So the Granadian Arabic-speaking Jews, according to the lead books, and the Jews of the New World, according to the Book of Mormon tradition, were both anciently introduced to Christianity, arriving at their appointed chosen lands of inheritance prior to Jesus' crucifixion. Since their travels predated the crucifixion by several centuries, according to what apologists are saying for the lead plates, they were absolved from the sin of deicide. It was, you know, almost a gracious argument to look at them and say, you're okay, you're clean from that sin. I think maybe if there is a parallel here, that might shed light on what we can think about the Book of Mormon text in regards to who the Lamanites were and what it means for them to have come to the New World during that time period. But back to the sealed plates of Granada, Spain. Decades after the discoveries, this guy by the name Alonso de Luna caused public stir by declaring a rather shocking account. Angels had taken him to the sixth heaven, where he was introduced to God. He was informed during this miraculous encounter that the time of resurrection was near, and that he was called by God to assist in the conversion of the world into a single faith by interpreting the sealed or mute book, which contained the fullness of the gospel. Here's a quote about what his claims were. How am I on time so far? Really? Okay. All right. That God had also revealed to him that all Catholic and evangelical truth was written in the books of the Holy Mountain of the city, and that there was an unreadable book which had not been read or understood until now, and that God had kept it for him to read and interpret and to publicize the conversion and final judgment in the manner referred to. Here's another interesting parallel, I think, because Alonso de Luna was one of two key figures that actually forged these plates. He was the son of Miguel de Luna, the main forger. Now, we've heard before, and many of us are already aware, that according to Joseph Smith and his relationship to Joseph Smith III, it was believed by early saints that Joseph Smith III would translate the sealed portion. Now, of course, he never did, right? Miguel de Luna's son never did because he was in prison for life for heresy. Anyways, I wish I had more to talk about. I do have more to talk about. I wish I had more time to do it. But, yeah, these ideas continue to persist. There were also, later on, other discoveries. Like in 1750, there was somebody who claimed that he had some other lead book to be translated. These things were preserved in artwork depicting overt references of the Granada plates and relics. There was also civil ritual that continued to be practiced. And then we also have fiction. Cervantes' Don Quixote actually refers to these lead books and parchments that are found in the grave. I don't know if you remember that reference about these plates that are found, or not these plates, but the parchment roll that's found in the lead book. It's referring to that, as current scholarship is showing. Anyways, the Vatican, when they declared it to be forgeries, in 1682 they took the plates and wouldn't allow anybody to look at them, to translate them. And it wasn't until 2000, 15 years ago, right, that they've been released to Granada. Granada now, the Granada Church has them, right? But the Granada Church held on to them for another 10 years because they weren't ready to release them. And it wasn't until 2010, 5 years ago, that these records are now accessible once again. And so there is this huge project that's happening right now. It hasn't been published, but they plan to finally provide a complete translation of these lead books, and I look forward to that. Thank you.
Well, we're short on time, which means I will read this like an auctioneer for you. I also don't have but this is suitable to what I'm talking about. And Mike, you opened a really nice door for me, so I'm just going to step right through that. The title of my talk is Lies, Damned Lies, and Spiritual Texts. I'm going to talk a little about the coming forth of the Zohar. I've added on there the coming forth of the Zohar and the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon thing is incidental. I'll hardly mention it at all. I think it will come to your mind without my mentioning it. The brilliance of the Zohar, first shown over 13th century Spain through the efforts of Rabbi Moses de Leon. De Leon is credited with revealing for the very first time the various manuscripts comprising the Zohar. Ostensibly compiled by the great Talmudic scholar Shimon bar Yochai and his son, Eleazar ben Shimon, the Zohar represents what many believe, even today, they believe that to be the confidential aspect of the oral teaching of the Torah. The unique theological perspective and fourfold hermeneutic of the Zohar continues to characterize Kabbalistic study to this day. And the story goes back a little bit. In 135 CE, the Roman Emperor Hadrian plowed under the entire city of Jerusalem, and in that process killed nearly 500,000 Jews. And this is the end of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. Now, fleeing Roman persecution, Rabbi Shimon and his son were said to have hidden a cave for 13 years, eluding Roman authorities. And during this time, we're told, the two were miraculously preserved by the hand of God, who caused a carob tree to grow by the entrance of the cave. Sort of like the story of Elijah. In fact, they were visited by the prophet Elijah, according to this tradition, who encouraged the writing of the sacred record. Not merely a book, the Zohar appears to represent numerous discourses between Shimon Bar Yochai and a circle of his closest associates. But many people believe that the real miracle of the Zohar was in its coming forth. The text itself prophesied that it would at first remain hidden to appear precisely 1,200 years after the destruction of the Jerusalem temple. The temple was raised in the year 70, and it's traditionally believed that just prior to 1270, while in a cave in Israel, Moses de Leon discovered the sacred records comprising the Zohar. That's one story. These records were brought to Spain by de Leon, and while he never showed the original records to anyone, he claimed that this ancient manuscript, written in Aramaic by Shimon Bar Yochai, was the source of the leaflets and related transcriptions he made and distributed over the course of several years. Yet from the very beginning, detractors argued that the Zohar was not what it appeared to be at first blush. Sages of that period were divided about the authenticity of the book. For instance, there were questions about the provenance of the manuscript of the Zohar and how it had arrived in Spain, in Avila, where Moses de Leon lived. Some firmly believed in its antiquity, and that Rabbi Nachmanides had sent the manuscript from Palestine to his son in Spain. And others suspected that Moses de Leon wrote the book himself, using either true mastery of the holy name, that was one theory, or deliberate trickery in his pursuit of wealth. Writing in the 19th century, scholar Heinrich Gritz scathingly dismissed Moses de Leon as a charlatan, a fake, and an imposter. De Leon was a despicable swindler, asserted Gritz, and had attempted to capitalize on the popularity of the Kabbalah, notoriously forging the Zohar as a money-making scheme, he said. The question about Moses de Leon is only whether he was a selfish or a pious imposter. His intention was certainly to make use of the Kabbalah, which had come into fashion, to procure for himself a rich source of revenue. Now, historical evidence regarding the actual authorship of the Zohar is very thin. One of the few relevant accounts comes from the noted Kabbalist, Rabbi Isaac of Acre. Now, Rabbi Isaac had fled for Spain when Acre was conquered by the Muslims in 1291. Things were just cooking in Spain about that time in regards to the Zohar, even though it had been around a little while. It took a while for things to kind of get excited there. Now, when Rabbi Isaac had reached Spain, he investigated the circumstances of the writing and distribution of the Zohar. His testimony is briefly summarized as follows. Isaac had gone to Spain specifically to learn how the book of the Zohar, which Rabbi Shimon and his son, Rabbi Eleazar, composed in the cave, came to exist in his time. This is a quote. Since I saw that its words were wonderful, drawn from the celestial source, I pursued it and asked the scholars who possessed some of its great words of wisdom whence they'd come by these wonderful mysteries, and how they'd been transmitted orally and not written down, and that they were now playing for all who could read, you know, via the Zohar. And I did not find their answers to my questions very convincing. Some said one thing, some said another. Some said in answer to my question that the faithful rabbi, Nachmanides, as we just discussed, had sent it from the land of Israel to Catalonia, to his son, and the wind had brought it to Aragon, and others say to Alicante, and it had fallen into the hands of the sage Rabbi Moses de Leon. Some say that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai didn't write the book at all, but that this Rabbi Moses knew the holy name and through its power wrote these wonderful words. And in order to sell them for a good price, much silver and gold, he ascribed them to our great ancestors, saying, I have transcribed for you these words from the book composed by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son. Well, Rabbi Isaac actually met with Moses de Leon. And he spoke with me and swore, may God do so to me and more also, if there is not at this moment in my house where I live in Avila, the ancient books written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and when you come to see me there, I shall show it to you. Rabbi Moses left me after this, but on his way home to Avila, he died. He says, when I heard the news, I was furious, and I resumed my journey. He goes there to Avila, and there he found a great scholar, and he said, I adjured him, saying, do you know the mysteries of the Zohar about which people are divided, some saying one thing and some another? Rabbi Moses swore an oath to me, but did not complete his promise before he died, so that I do not know whose authority to rely on. And this particular rabbi said, well, there was no Zohar, original text of the Zohar. Wasn't there. And he says, and God do so to me, you know, if I'm lying to you about this. And he said that Moses de Leon's wife had confessed that this was the case. Now listen to this. This is interesting. She said, may God do so to me and more also if my husband ever possessed such a book. But he wrote what he did out of his own head and heart and knowledge and mind. And when I saw him writing without any material before him, I used to say to him, why do you tell everybody that you are copying from a book when you have no book and you write it out of your own head? Would it not be better for you just to say, you know, that it was your own work? Because then you would get more credit. And he would reply, if I told them my secret, that what I wrote was my own invention, then they'd pay no heed to my words and would not give me a penny for them, because they would say that I'd made it all up. But as it is, when they hear that I'm copying extracts for them from the Zohar that was written under the influence of the Holy Spirit by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, then they pay a lot of money for them, as you can see for yourself. So Rabbi Isaac, this is interesting though, he said, when I had heard what he had to say, I was astounded and amazed, and I really believed that there had never been a book that had been written pieces for other people through the power of the Holy Name. And later Isaac met another scholar who said that, yes, he actually did have this book. And the reason he knew that is because he tested Moses de Leon. He said, well, I'll just skip this. How he tested him was, he had him write out a piece from the Zohar for his personal use. And then he took it, and he waited a couple of months, and he went back to Moses de Leon, and he said, you know, I lost some pages out of that transcript you gave me. Could you do that again? And he said, tell me the place you started, that quote started and where it stopped, and I'll recopy it for you. And he did. And so, for this rabbi, that was proof positive that the text was authentic. And Rabbi Isaac appeared to have believed that until he began talking to other scholars. He said, what's to prevent, you know, Moses de Leon from having the original transcript, that he copied one for himself as well when he wrote that out the first time, and he's just comparing with his own copy of that, right, that he made for himself. He said, well, I didn't know what to think about. So the question here is whether the text was historically accurate, but notice how they choose to phrase it if it's not. They still credit Moses de Leon with having created the Zohar through the power of the Holy Name. In other words, by the gift and power of God. Even if it wasn't the document that it had been claimed historically. So even critics kind of hedged their bets on this one, right? I want to point out that they're forced to admit the text's spiritual power, conceding that if the work were not in fact that of Shimon Bar Yochai, that it was at the very least the product of the power of the Holy Name, of which Rabbi Moses was apparently a master. The perceived spiritual power of the text itself is subtly advanced as a witness to its spiritual, if not historical, authenticity. Now, while his ultimate reasoning is unclear because we don't have his full account, Rabbi Isaac eventually concludes that the Zohar was originally written by Shimon Bar Yochai. We have no idea why he made that conclusion after presenting all the evidence that he did. And it may seem a bit odd that given such historical ambiguity, the Zohar has been largely accepted as authentic. I'd suggest, based upon the commentary that I've seen, that a significant reason the Zohar continues to convince many Kabbalists that it is the actual production of Shimon Bar Yochai is because it is not seen as possible that such a rich text could have been authored by one man. To some, that Moshe de Leon was able to fabricate this masterful work of profound spiritual depth, richness, and diversity of philosophical perspective, and of such immense scope, it's over 1,700 pages of Aramaic, within a period of roughly 6 years, seems to argue against it being de Leon's sole invention in their minds. Some have therefore speculated that Moses de Leon was the leader of a Kabbalistic community which produced the Zohar as a collaborative effort, distributed in small tracts over the course of several years. Modern scholars continue to point out the anachronistic events in the Zohar, words and doctrines appearing within its pages, anachronistic words, doctrines. They note that the usual form of Aramaic under the strange linguistic features, and under strange, they note the unusual form of Aramaic and other, strange linguistic features. So, they note those things, yet Kabbalists still aver that this text is authentic. So I wanted to talk a moment, this is kind of the meat of what I'm getting to, it's about textual fakery and authentic spirituality. Discussion of how authentic spiritual practice may rest upon dubious historical claims is difficult for some. In this context, it's perhaps important to stress again that the Zohar was not considered a mere treatise on the Bible. Unlike such works, it was prepended with the word holy. That is, it was the holy Zohar. It was scripture and the core of the mystical teaching embraced by nearly every Jew during the 15th and 16th centuries. The Zohar refashions an older tradition, introduces its own doctrines and approaches consistent with the Kabbalah, and also almost certainly is a historical fake. Almost certainly a forgery with deep roots in early Judaism, but nevertheless. Now, there's a scholar and occultist, Robert Wayne, who talks about this in the Western mystery tradition today. He says, the question of purposeful deception about the origins of many esoteric manuscripts is a serious and difficult one, usually judiciously avoided by writers in the Western mystery tradition who wish to cast their beliefs in the most positive light. But the tally of literature, some of which is based on the Zohar, I might point out, the tally of literature for which antiquity is falsely claimed is so great that the very consistency of such claims becomes intriguing. Among such texts would be the Book of the Law, as Mike points out, the Zohar itself, the Hermetica, which we've already talked about today, Freemasonry and its tradition, although they're pretty upfront about the fact that that's allegorical. Nevertheless, claims to have begun in the Garden of Eden in the time of Solomon. the Rosicrucian manifestos, which we were talking about texts coming out of a tomb. That's a tradition that duplicates that as well. And the ancient cipher manuscripts. Now we can multiply these at some length. But I want to close with just three small quotes, and then I'll leave the rest of my stuff here. Examples of this sort can be multiplied, but in all such cases of fakery, deception, or whatever it may be called, we find authors under pressure of the public's essential belief that the more traditional work, the more valid it is. On the other hand, every one of those works which he have listed here as having fraudulent origins claimed for stands on its own as enlightened. These are the inspired works of men and women who have known. Those who remain unconvinced that a work of spurious pedigree might have great spiritual worth should look very closely at the history of Christianity, as well as the particular amalgam of heterogeneous texts found in the Bible. Thank you very much.
Okay, we've only got 10 minutes left, so I'm really going to try and pull this together and edit out some of the things that I might have said. Okay, I think this was a really interesting set of papers and a really nice topic for exploring here in highlighting parallels between the Book of Mormon as a material artifact and a number of other non-biblical texts. But I think, at least for me, it helps to think about this, to think about what we're going to make of all these parallels that our presenters have brought out. And I can think of at least three different frameworks that we could look at them in, the parallels in. And I think they're all legitimate, but I think it's important to keep them distinct in our minds. So one is what I would call a historical developmental approach, which would investigate whether there's a direct historical connection between the Book of Mormon and the parallels that are being discussed, either at the point of origin, i.e. making the claim that Joseph Smith himself was thinking about these parallels when he materialized the plates, dictated the narrative, etc., or that around that time, others were making those connections. Then we could take what I would call a religious studies comparative approach, which wouldn't necessarily claim any historical connection, but would use the parallels as a means of exploring the similarities and differences between the cases in order to understand both of the cases better, but would do so out of an interest in, say, new religious movements or in human behavior more generally. And then the third would be what I would call a theological approach, which, like a religious studies approach, would not necessarily claim any historical connection, but would think about the parallels from within the tradition, within the LDS tradition, for example, using these parallels to interpret, critique, or elaborate on the tradition in light of the parallels. So I'm not totally clear in the case of all our presenters where they would fall in terms of these different kinds of claims that they would want to make in relation to these parallels. And I also think that they're dealing with a tradition where Smith and his followers were constantly going through a process of reinterpretation. So there's a whole question of at what point, if they were thinking these things, then that they started to think them. So let me just briefly comment then on each of the papers. I just heard Joe's Swick's paper along with you guys, but I would say that both his and Michael's draw out fascinating parallels, but left me with not very much of a sense of what conclusions they wanted to draw from them. I think that Joe was maybe a little bit more explicit in suggesting that his point might have been that textual fakes may still be spiritually significant. And in making that point, I'm not quite sure who he wants to be addressing that to, if it's primarily to an LDS audience that he wants to think about the Book of Mormon that way, or if he's making a broader sort of religious studies point. In terms of Mike's paper, he noted so many interesting parallels that I could see a bunch of potential claims that he might want to be making there. And I could go through a series of questions to ask him to sort that out for us, but I'm looking at the time and I'm not going to give you my list. Because I want to turn to each of them. So with Trevor Luke's paper, he focuses our attention on the gold plates as an esoteric artifact, and he gets closer to making a historical developmental argument, and that's what I want to focus on, is how much of that is he really trying to make. So he says he wants to reflect on how our visions of the Book of Mormon as an artifact, informed by the narratives of its production and handling and artistic depictions of it, bear on the construction of the culture that reveres the book. This could be a theological argument or a historical developmental argument. From a historical point of view, I can see why Luke might want to argue that the recovery of the plates was more like an esoteric initiation than an archaeological discovery, but I'm not ready to assume that Smith and his associates viewed the recovered plates in 1827 or 1828 that way. As he uses Don Bradley's book In Process and his paper in which he, quote, perceptively identified the treasure trove as a Nephite Ark of the Covenant. This seems to be based on the Fayette Laugham interview, which was recounted in 1840, may go back to 1830. If it's late, and it also comes from what Latham heard Joseph Smith Sr. allegedly tell him. So I'd be more comfortable sticking to evidence that's closer to the time, closer to what I'd call real-time evidence of how they were interpreting it at the time. And my sense is that what we probably have is a text that can be interpreted in more than one way, that is more ambiguous at the time that it's being dictated, and not fully categorized, and has the potential then to be read with an esoteric reading or Masonic reading, or with clearly a biblical reading, but also with a treasure-seeking reading. So my sense is that a lot of the interpretations probably came later. And I think this is the connections between the Book of Mormon and Masonic teachings, and connections between that and biblical allusions. I suspect a lot of this came later as insights, as people thought about what was in the Book of Mormon. And I can demonstrate evidence for this in terms of the biblical text by comparing Lucy Smith's account letter in 1831, which is largely self-authenticating. Her claims for the authenticity of the Book of Mormon are based on Book of Mormon internal evidence, as opposed to, if we look at Joseph Smith's histories, if we look at 1832 and then 1839, we see the beginnings of references to the Christian, to the Bible as a means of authenticating the new revelation, the Book of Mormon. We see a few in 1832, but by 1839, we see tons of references to the Bible as authenticating the legitimacy and authenticity of the Book of Mormon. So it seems to me that that's a development that they're thinking about during the 30s. And now to turn to Cheryl's, which I deliberately left for last, because it seems to me that she is most clearly trying to construct a historical developmental account. And So that she's saying at some point between 1823 and 1833, a Masonic connection with these events was forged, and later narratives appended details apparently to augment the relationship. I'll buy that. That's a pretty big window. And in terms of the actual evidence she gives us for that interpretation, she's looking to Cowdery in 1835, to Pratt in 1839, and to Joseph Smith's 1839 history. She also looks back to the Fayette Latham interview. So it seems to me that we can probably see two strands developing of Mormon interpretation of the Book of Mormon in the 30s that are bringing out aspects of the Book of Mormon that could plausibly be interpreted in terms of the larger Masonic / esoteric narratives and in terms of biblical narratives. But that these insights were coming to people over time and weren't somehow all there, I would bet, in Joseph Smith's mind at the point of the narration of the text.